Hunt wishes to thank the following partners, the AO Group School at the Long Creek Youth Development Center, Terrascope Youth Radio at the Massachusetts International of Technology, Youth Radio from Youth Media International in Oakland, California.
It has to start somewhere. It has to start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now?
What's your contribution going to be? What problems are you going to solve? What discoveries will you make?
I intend to broadcast from this ship 24 hours a day until the day I die. And then for a couple days after that.
No one's written your destiny for you. You make your own future.
I've always lived for news and weather. Happy to die for them too. Especially the weather.
Whether it's foxes, possums, or skunks in your backyard, groundhogs and Japanese beetles in your garden, or seagulls and chickadees flying in the sky above, they can be native or invasive, seen in urban or rural areas. Wild animals and marine life are all around us, and they make up our identity as Mainers.
Tonight, you're listening to Blunt Youth Radio. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
And tonight, we're discussing wildlife, aquatic, and foresty. We're discussing the natural wildlife around us, the ocean and the forest. We'll be talking to our guests who will be speaking with us from the National Natural Resource Council of Maine and the Natural Resource Department for the Penobscot Nation, talking to us about salmon and
the removal of the VZ Dam.
And we'll be discussing the many pieces that our Blunt members and pieces we have about lobster and
living in Maine. I mean, we are surrounded by wild animals and often interact with them. So throughout the first half of the show will be exactly sharing stories. I have a story to share, as Olivia does as well. So we encourage listeners to call in. The number is 780-4909. Again, that's 780-4909. Now, I had said that, you know, the animals, like the wildlife and marine life, that are in Maine, you know, make up our identity. And, you know, we're known for you know, the wildlife that we have. And I wanted to know, like, what animal, if there was one animal, like, that best represented Maine as a whole, like, what that animal would be and what, you know, how, you know, people on the street think about the animals in Maine. So I went down to Tommy's Park in Portland, and later the Pier in Portland, and I talked to people on the street. So without further ado, we're going to play that piece. The question is, what animal do you feel best represents Maine and why?
I think the deer, and just because they're so beautiful, and Maine's a beautiful state.
Seagulls, because they're just scum and rat, and they just try to take whatever you can get, you know, whatever they can get. Whatever you leave, you know, they come at you. It's everywhere.
I say a black bear, because Maine's pretty friendly, and black bears are actually more friendly than most people think, but they can get pretty aggressive if they have to.
There was a sign next to the highway on the way in that said, beware of moose. So I guess I would have to say moose.
And where were you from again, just so I can...
Baltimore, Maryland.
Nice. And would you think moose as well?
I would think lobster.
You know, Baltimore is all about blue crab. We're going to try some of the lobster up here to see how it compares to the blue crab of the Chesapeake.
I would say the moose.
And why is that?
I think I've seen it on commercials. I think a lot of people think of Maine
All right. Now I'm down at the pier, Portland Pier. And I'm going to go see what the people fishing have to say about Maine and its wildlife and its marine life. So what you want to repeat that for me again?
The lobster.
And what is that?
It is Maine.
What animal do you think about when you think of Maine?
Lobster.
Why is that?
Because it's what you see most. Maine.
Do you like eating lobster?
And do you catch it? Or
no.
So while on the pier, I saw many people fishing. And I guess today they're all hoping to get some mackerel. And one fisherman in particular was having a bit of trouble with the blues, which I would find out are little fish that are kind of a nuisance eating the bait. But they're all hoping to catch the bigger mackerel. It was a pretty great scene. I mean, there's, you know, your older men, but, you know, young kids, you know, families. So, you know, kind of a diverse crowd, more experienced with, you know, new beginners. And I guess I wasn't too surprised that, you know, the couple people that I spoke to on the pier said lobster, being right down by the water. You know, lobster, I guess, is one of the things you think about when you think of Maine.
So we just listened to a piece that Iris did asking people what animal they thought best represented Maine. And we have a caller, Ed from Portland.
Hello, good evening.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. I was just curious, I didn't hear it in the intro to the piece, whether or not you asked the folks if they were Mainers or if they were from away. I think that would give a totally different perspective on what they thought, you know, how Maine should be identified with an animal.
The majority of them were Mainers. There was one couple, it was a father and son who were from Baltimore, and they had said that, well, the father had said moose because of the signs on the highway, and the son said lobster, and it was safe to assume that most of them were from Maine, but yes, I do agree. It would definitely change the perspective a lot.
Now,
yeah, and I would think a lot of the folks down by the pier would probably, although one can't safely assume, that people at the pier are tourists and they're from away.
Now, Ed, are you from away, or are you a Mainer?
I'm a maniac.
And what?
I've been away.
Now, what animal do you think best represents Maine?
The white-tailed deer.
Mm-hmm.
The white-tailed. It's such a magnificent animal and beautiful symbol of our state. That hands down, white-tailed deer.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And thank you, Ed, for calling in. And if you have a question for listeners, if you have a question or comment, if you have a story about, you know, an interaction with a wild animal, please share. The number is 780-4909. That's 780-4909. Being down on the pier near the water, I mean, yeah, people said lobster, but I mean, if you were in northern Maine, I mean, it would, you know, definitely be a different response, but I don't know. I mean, those are all, you know, animals that we see in Maine, and
yeah, driving around northern areas, we'll sometimes see deer on the side of the road. When I was discussing, I was talking actually with my grandfather today a bit about this subject of wildlife in Maine and the environment in Maine. I was asking him about if through his lifetime, he's 80 years old, if he had seen a change in the animals and how much he sees them or does not see them. And he said that when he was a kid, you would see deer around a lot more, and you'd see them in really large groups around the woods. But now you can, only ever so often see one or two on the sides of the road. And we were discussing how that, could be about human encroachment on the wildlife and the land and just pollution and global warming, et cetera. But he's noticed a difference.
Mm-hmm. And something else that has changed over the years, and we have a piece from the Salt Institute that talks about it, is, being in Maine, lobstering is a huge industry, and, lobster, well, the piece is The Alchemy of the Lobster Fishing, and...
It's from the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. Let's give it a listen.
Julie Eaton is a lobsterman with a sense of humor. The name of her boat? The Cat Sass. She enjoys being her own boss, and she loves the lifestyle.
All winter I wait every day to get back on my boat. I have friends that live out of state, and they think it's such a big deal to have an office.
All right.
We'll be coming back to this piece, but the reason we wanted to play it is there's a Portland Press Herald article
that was just published August 8th that the headline is "Soft Shell Lobsters Seem Like a Hard Sell in Maine,"
and it's because the low prices of lobsters are really frustrating lobstermen and so the piece discusses that, but it's true in Maine. We do, the relationship we have with wildlife, we rely on them in our economy, and
it's a huge part of the economy.
Lobstering or to bring in tourists. Maine is known for its nature and wildlife. And
I remember reading one time, I'm not sure if this is true, and I don't know if it's still true, I read somewhere that Maine is or used to be the largest producer of blueberries in the country. I know we still produce a lot of potatoes, but that's part of our environment and part of our symbiotic relationship with wildlife in our environment. So now we will be playing The Alchemy of Lobster Fishing from the Salt Institute of Documentary Studies. Again, we may be getting back to that piece. And I'd like to remind our listeners that this is Blunt Youth Radio. We're discussing...
Mm-hmm.
And sorry,
I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
My headphones just made it sound like I couldn't hear myself, so...
And with me...
With Iris is Olivia Bradstreet, and I'd like to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show. The number is 780-4909. That's 780-4909. And we'd really like to hear from you about your thoughts on how wildlife has changed or has not changed in Maine through the years. Issues in the environment you'd like to bring up.
And I'm just going to talk about... early last week, I went camping with my family in Cub Cove, Sebago State Park, and it's just relaxing to be in nature. But one story I got from that was, we had sort of like a private beach, and I was relaxing in the sun, and on a rock I see, what I thought was first a monarch butterfly because of its coloring, but later I would find out that it was, I believe it was a moth. Anyways, so this, you know, moth was also sunbathing in the sun, and I was admiring it. All of a sudden, a wave comes and pulls the moth into the water, and I'm like, ah! And I jump to its rescue, and I put my finger in the water, and it, you know, grabs on, and it's, you know, drenched. Its wings are, you know, together, looking really damaged. So I sit with it in the sun, hoping that with the warm air, its wings would dry, mm-hmm. and it would be able to hopefully fly away. And so I sit with it for some time, and finally it does open up its wings. And then I sit with it some longer time.
Hope it will just warm up and
you
be
know,
free,
nothing
little
happens. And you know, at this point, I'm like, all right, I'm missing out on, you know, some, you know, family camping activities. You know, I'll set it down on this towel that's on a, you know, picnic table in the sun, and, you know, leave it to fly away on its own. So I set it down, and literally seconds later, my sister unknowingly sets a book down on this moth. And I'm like, ah, like all of this effort I've taken to, you know, try to save this moth, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's gone through so much already. Like, this would be a terrible way to die. And, you know, she notices it right away and picks up the book, and like my family, we all watch as the moth flies away into the sky, you know, into the trees, and it was
Yay,
just a, it was
happy story.
It was a happy story, because I mean, I was filled with a lot of doubt, but I'm happy things worked out the way they did.
And now we're going to play a friend of. We're going to play a story that our friend of ours, Trenton, and Blunt Youth Radio member told us about his experiences with the wildlife around him.
And we encourage you to call in if you have a story to share. 780-4909. Again, 780-4909.
Let's give this piece a listen.
Is what animal do you feel best represents Maine and why?
I think the deer. And just because they're so beautiful. And Maine's a beautiful state.
All right, so me and my family, we're camping, I believe, on Sebago Lake, or I think it was Saco River, and I was swimming in the river, and I heard this noise. I looked up, and I saw a nest of birds, and they were frantically, you know, chirping, flying around the nest, and I looked down, and lo and behold, there's a little baby bird drowning in the river. So, oh no, what do I do? So, what I finally decided to do is, in the spur of the moment, I decide to strip down into my underwear and try to save this little baby bird. I was 12 years old, so I mean, I was all by myself, but I get this little bird, and it's shivering from the cold water, and I try to save it. So I put it in a little container, hoping it'll dry up, and after a few hours, it finally started to move and started to chirp, so I tried to feed it, you know, crushed worms or whatever I thought a little baby bird would eat. And the next day, me and my dad brought it to Gray's Animal Farm because they would know how to, you know, care for it better. So we brought it to Gray's Animal Farm, and I believe the bird recovered well, but I'm not sure. So
the question is, what animal? All right, so that was Trenton Johnson's story.
About saving a little baby bird. And you are listening to Blunt Youth Radio. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Iris Sangiovanni. Do you have a story? Share with us. 780-4909. Again, 780-4909. We have about 10 minutes until break, so pick up your phones and dial.
We want to hear from you.
And so We have a poem.
That we thought would be interesting to play. Or read.
To read, yes. I was going to read it. It's a poem entitled When the Animals Come to Us by Gary Lawless. When the animals come to us, asking for our help, will we know what they are saying? When the plants speak to us in their delicate, beautiful language, will we be able to answer them? When the planet herself sings to us in our dreams, will we be able to wake ourselves and act? Again, that was by Gary Lawless. And I really like that poem, and it will sort of tie into what we're going to be talking about second half, but I think it is our job, because the wild animals, you know, give so much to us, that in return, the least we can do is to, you know, to protect them and care for them, whether it's the simple acts of just rescuing a baby bird in a river or, you know, a moth, to larger acts of, you know, dam removal or in river restoration.
Or taking care of animals in a harmless way. We currently have a groundhog in my backyard that's been, you know, we plan to take care of it with a have-a-heart trap, which, if you don't know what that is, it's just a simple trap that's safe for the animal and you release it into the wild. Basically, we have a groundhog that goes and picks apples from our apple tree and sits down in the middle of the yard eating it. And it just hangs out. It's the neighborhood groundhog that apparently goes from yard to yard.
So sometimes these animals can be a little pesty and, you know.
But you got to deal with them gently. Yeah. So we have a caller, Gail from Washington County. Hello, Gail. You're on the air. Thanks for calling. So we'll be speaking. Oh, hello. Hi, Gail. Are you there?
Speak up. We can't hear you.
So we'll be speaking.
A little bit louder, if you could.
Hi, Gail. A little bit louder.
It's that. Oh, it's okay. Thanks.
If you could also turn down your radio if you're listening to it. We're just getting feedback.
So, yes, we'd like to remind our callers that when you call in, just turn down your radio so you can hear us and we can hear you.
And the number is 780-4909.
Tell us your animal story. All right, Gail, are you on the phone? Gail, can you hear us?
Oh, shoot.
All right.
Well, while we take care of that, Olivia, so, I mean, this groundhog, sort of a nuisance in your garden. What are some ways that you, what steps have you taken to sort of, you know, push this creature gently out?
Well, what we do at our homestead, which is in a different location, we just put an electric fence around the big garden. So if any animal tests it, it says ow and it moves on. So we get plenty of way too much yellow squash, but
seems a bit harsh,
but it's also, I don't know, they get to eat so much, there's so much land to roam around that they don't need to eat zucchini. But at my more urban garden, we've, you know, put some soiled cat litter in its hiding hole so it thinks there's a predator and it'll move out. Doesn't seem perturbed. He's a big, big groundhog who seems very happy to be eating well. All right, now we have another caller, Amy from Fortunes Rocks Beach. Hello, Amy?
Hi, I'm from Old Orchard Beach.
Ah, somebody wrote you down as Fortunes Rocks. And I'd like to also tell our listeners that Amy is my mother.
Hello.
So, hello, Mom.
Well, when I was a child, I lived down east in Castine, Maine, which is on Penobscot Bay. And as kids, we would just go down to the docks in town, and we would fish off the docks with those, I don't remember what they're called, but there's these little fishing lines we would just drop out over the side of the dock. And it was a lot of fun. And we never knew what we would catch, if we would catch anything. But there were times where we would pull up really interesting things. And sometimes, being, you know, ages 5 through, like, 10 years old.
Just hanging out on the docks.
Yeah. we'd get unexpected things like crabs hanging off the side of our lines or sort of like puffer-looking type fish. And one time, I must have been about 7, I pulled up a squid that was still very much alive, and it kind of scared me because it suckered right onto my arm, and it wouldn't let go. And I was a little bit panicked by it, but really intrigued by it at the same time. And I'm trying to figure out how to get this suckering squid off of my arm. And of course, there's all kinds of other people who are fishing off the docks. And I had no interest in keeping the squid or taking it home with me. And but as we finally got it off, I think there were other children helping me. there was this woman who, you know, she was kind of, picture your elderly, very much a Down East Yankee, fishing off the dock for her, you know, her evening supper. And she had a chum bucket next to her and a couple other buckets. Mm-hmm. And she was very happy to take the squid off my hands. And I think that was the thing that shocked me the most, is that she was very happy to have the squid and take it home and eat it.
So, Maine, there you go.
Yeah, so that was just my little story.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
And now
we're just going to jump into it. We have another caller. We have Big Time Harold from South Portland. Hi there.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you? Do you have a story or question or comment to share?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, talking about all the creatures here in Maine, from the moose, the white-tailed deer. Don't forget the old Maine bobcat. Mm. And but this is about the old hominis americanus, the crustacean known as the lobster, known worldwide for its tastiness, its delectability. I was out pulling pots one day in my lobster boat. Came, it was quite foggy, so I come up over a wave, and I saw another lobsterman. So I pulled alongside, and I asked him, I said, "Are you talking to yourself?" And he says, "Yes, I enjoy speaking to an intelligent man, and I enjoy listening to one as well." And with that, off he went in search of his pots. And so there you go, from the rock-bound coast of Maine.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing.
Yes, my pleasure. You enjoy yourselves and enjoy your radio.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, humans are an animal also.
That's
so that's
true.
An interesting story from Big Time Harold. All right. So now we'd like to remind our listeners to tell these stories. We want to hear your wild animal stories or your wild oceanic stories. And our number is 780-4909. That is 780-4909.
And stay tuned because second half we are going to be talking about the removal of the VZ Dam on the Penobscot River and the restoration project in place. And again, we'll be speaking with Nick Bennett, who's from a scientist with the Natural Resource Council of Maine, as well as John Banks, the director of the Resources Department for the Penobscot Indian Nation. So please stay tuned. I'm Iris San Giovanni.
And I'm Olivia Bradstreet. You've been listening to Blunt Youth Radio.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. was hoping for replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Welcome back to Blunt Youth Radio. We're a public affairs, youth-run, call-in talk show.
I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
And we've been talking about
wildlife in the Gulf of Maine.
You know, and we've been listening, we've been hearing from our listeners about their individual wildlife stories. We heard about somebody's interaction with a human part of the wildlife. We've heard somebody talk, you know, someone called in about, you know, fishing off the side of a dock and pulling up strange creatures.
And now we're sort of going to redirect our focus. So only 3 weeks ago, contractors began removing the VZ Dam on the Penobscot River near Old Town, which would reopen Old Town to the sea for the first time in nearly 200 years. And the removal is but before we get into this, we did have a piece that didn't air in the first half, and it was by a reporter, Matt Osman.
It'll be continuing this theme of trying to save creatures in our habitat here in Maine. So we have a piece by Matt Osman. Here you go.
A wild animal I have on Saturday morning. When I was going to my horseback riding lesson, we had just turned onto Warren Avenue, and my mom saw a lot of traffic there. At first, we weren't sure what it was. Maybe a little dog. As we got closer, we saw a hurt red-tailed hawk. There were lots of seagulls circling. There was bread scattered in the road for some reason. We pulled over and got out of the car to try helping the bird. I had to stop traffic so the cars would not hurt the hawk or my mother. So many people pulled over just to watch this incredible rescue. It made me feel good to see so many people care. It was really windy, so the blanket my mom had put over the hawk was blowing. I stood on one side of the blanket. The blanket was to keep it from being too scared. Then some people came over to help us and they gave us a cardboard box so we could bring it to Sparks, Ark, and Wyndham. We tried calling Mr. Sparks, but he wasn't home. So we went to the Westbrook Animal Rescue League. They took in the red-tailed hawk and saw it was pretty hurt. A volunteer was experienced with wild birds. She put on a motorcycle helmet to protect her. If the hawk tried to peck at her eyes, she also wore gloves that had metal inside of them. They said that Mr. Sparks had a family emergency and wouldn't be home. The hawk's best hope was going to the York Center for Wildlife in Cape Natick, Maine. They didn't have anyone available to drive the hawk, so my mom and I drove there. So much for my horseback riding lesson. When we got to York Wildlife Center, they took the hawk in. They gave us a number to call to check in on how he did. We hung out for a while and learned so much from them. For example, the reason the red-tailed hawk probably got hit was that there was food on the side of the road. This food attracts other animals that the hawk can eat. The hawk was probably hit when it dove to get an animal that was eating food from the road. We realized that our habit of throwing out an apple core or other food from our car window was causing birds and other animals to come close to the road. For example, why do you think there are so many crows on the side of the road? Because we throw food out. We went home feeling hopeful and excited that we helped save this beautiful bird. But it turns out the hawk had to be put to sleep. The wings were too broken and it had a head injury. I felt pretty sad that the red-tailed hawk didn't make it, but I'm glad we tried to save it. It took our whole day. I had to cancel my horseback riding, and we had to drive an hour each way, but it was worth it. I'd do it again, for I really like helping our wildlife, and I learned so much while I did it. Thank you, Red-tailed Hawk. This is Matt Asman, reporting from WMPG, Blunt Youth Radio, Portland, Maine.
So we just listened to a piece by Matt Asman, who's a Blunt member. Thank you very much for recording that piece. And that was talking about, trying to help out and save this wild animal. And now we're going to be talking about Atlantic salmon, whose numbers are dropping all over the world, and an animal, a creature that we have the ability, I think, to help save. So this is a piece called Upstream from Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
And it'll be giving you a little bit of backstory to our next discussion. Let's go ahead and listen to it.
So we'll listen to the... We'll listen to that piece in a little bit. So
now I'm going to introduce what we will be discussing. So only 3 weeks ago, contractors began removing the VZ Dam on the Penobscot River near Old Town, which would reopen Old Town to the sea for the first time in nearly 200 years. The removal is a result of the collaborative work of a variety of groups, including the Penobscot Nation, 7 conservation groups, hydropower companies, and state and federal agencies. With the VZ Dam removed, people, fish, and wildlife will all be impacted. And here to discuss these impacts, we have Nick Bennett, a staff scientist from the Natural Resource Council of Maine, and joining him, John Banks, the director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Indian Nation.
And again, we'll be talking to them about this issue that we're going to listen to in this piece, Upstream from Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
Despite its name, the Pleasant River Hatchery is basically a small, dark basement. It consists of little more than 2 troughs and a set of trays, but inside these trays is around 150,000 newly hatched salmon swimming around. Jacob Van de Sandy, the hatchery manager, is suctioning out dead eggs.
We worry about our babies. It's a lot of responsibility.
Traditionally, the first salmon caught each year would be sent as a gift to the White House. Now, Gulf of Maine Atlantic salmon are almost extinct. Just 40 years ago, salmon fishing culture was a huge deal here.
That's what people did on a summer evening in early June, people would line up at the cable pool just to watch people salmon fish and watch someone land a fish. There might be 50, 60 people there just watching.
Atlantic salmon are big, around 20 pounds. They go through six life stages that take 7 years. They hatch as these gobs of orange with eyeballs, then grow into muddy-colored parr that feed in freshwater streams. They get bigger, turning silver to camouflage themselves in the ocean. And then they swim 2,000 miles to Greenland. Finally, they head home to breed. Gulf of Maine Atlantic salmon make this trip multiple times.
Salmon are a species that depends on wild, healthy watersheds in a lot of ways. They're very emblematic of sort of wilderness and clean water, and just knowing they're there makes people feel good.
Dams and pollution have dramatically impacted the population. Conservationists are fixing the streams. They're removing dams and felling trees to create a more diverse riverbed. But numbers continue to drop. So the focus turned to hatcheries. The federal hatchery produces 4 million eggs a year, but only 1,000 or 2 fish ever return from the ocean. Biologists like Jacob are taking a more hands-on approach. Not playing God exactly, more like a personal trainer in God's gym.
So the idea is we're raising athletes. We're going to put them out into the wild. They're going to have to be strong and vigorous if they're going to survive. So raising fat, you know, couch potato salmon is just not going to work.
The Downey Salmon Federation's hatcheries do their best to mimic the natural conditions of wild salmon. In many ways, this is a low-tech operation. The hatchery pumps in river water, insects and all. Once the eggs hatch, instead of being raised in the trays, the tiny fish are shifted to a wooden box filled with thousands of little bits of plastic. It's meant to replicate the riverbed.
And they go and hide.
And then they go and hide down in the dark because they like it dark. In fact, I think I see one right there. Yeah. So they're going to go down into there and they kind of disappear. It takes a little leap of faith because it's pitch black in there and I have no idea what's going on in there.
If this were a marathon, that'd be the pre-training. When the salmon are ready to eat, they swim up and drop into the tank below. Next comes endurance work. Like running the incline program on a treadmill, the hatchery ups the velocity of tank water, getting them ready to swim against stronger currents.
We have a flow arm that we attach here, and it has multiple adjustments, so we can change the angle and direction of the flow, and that's how we control the velocity of the water in the tank. In the very beginning, you want it very slow because they're little guys who don't want to wear them out.
The answer may be in something smaller, their genes. The state breeding program works with geneticists to minimize inbreeding and artificial selection. Salmon are specifically adapted to their native rivers. The hope is maintaining genetic diversity will make salmon more capable of surviving environmental changes. This is Jacob.
This fish that does well in a hatchery setting is not necessarily the same fish who's going to survive in the wild, so we're always balancing those things.
Scientists are battling a whole other, vaster unknown, the ocean. They don't understand why so few salmon are coming back. Kathy Mills is a researcher at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. She says whatever is happening in the ocean is affecting Atlantic salmon from all over the world.
It's surprising that over this broad geographic area, the patterns of change really are fairly consistent. And that points to something happening in the marine ecosystem when they're all mixed together.
Kathy thinks it's a domino effect. As water temperature rises, less smelt survive, leaving bigger fish with fewer prey. And it continues up the food chain to Atlantic salmon.
This decline seems to most affect the fish that stay at sea longer. And so this is important because when they are at sea longer, they obviously grow to a larger size. So fish that are coming back after being at sea longer have more eggs. Generally, the eggs are healthier. They're going to contribute much more reproductively to the population.
Jacob and other biologists continue to stock Maine's rivers, hoping to keep the genetic legacy alive. In early May, Jacob released 20,000 salmon at a stocking point in Pleasant River.
Yeah, I think so. Just taking a bucket full of fish. You know, the bottom third of it is pretty much full of fish. I'm just going to set it down in the water and just carefully let them. So right there, there's probably 5,000 little salmon just
on their way.
On their way, so it's pretty instinctive for them to just dive right to the bottom. You can see they're sort of lingering here and there, but you can see them scattered across the bottom. Their little spots starting to blend in with the bottom a little bit. They look pretty pretty naive right now.
For Salt Radio, I'm Megan Dietry.
Welcome back.
You're listening to Blunt Youth Radio on WMPG, W281AC, Gorham, Portland, and the weather is looking wicked nice for this week.
I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Iris San Giovanni, and we have our guests, Nick Bennett and John Banks, with us on the phone.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, thank you, and welcome to the show. Now, I first read that the removal of the Vizi Dam was an expensive improvement, and that sounded like a sort of contradictory or counterproductive thing. Don't we use energy from dams, or maybe, you know, maybe the dam was built in the first place for something and now it needs to be taken down, so why is that a good thing?
John, I'll let you handle this if you'd like.
Okay, Nick, I'll take a stab at this one. I think that the important thing to realize about the Penobscot River Restoration Project is that it's both a fish project and an energy project. Mm-hmm. It will actually end up, after it's all said and done, I think the system as a whole will actually be producing at least as much, if not more, power than it is now. And they were able to do that by shifting the generating assets around making some improvements in some of the existing dams, but actually removing the two lowermost dams in the system, which are most important from the standpoint of fish restoration.
And so, I mean, you both, you know, represent just, you know, two groups out of the many that worked together, together for the VZ removals. And again, John Banks, you're the director of Natural Resources Department for the Penobscot Indian Nation. And Nick Bennett, you're the staff scientist for the Natural Resources Council of Maine. So can you speak to, what was that like, working with perhaps groups that you wouldn't expect to work with collaboratively?
Well, I think it's been a good process. There are a lot of groups, you're right. It's always, there are challenges to making soup with lots of chefs, but this project has really been unique in how well the partners have worked together. I think that's safe to say.
Now, I read on the Natural Resource Council of Maine website in an older article, but perhaps this is still true, that the takedown, the removal of the Vizi Dam would be beneficial to the Penobscot Nation, and I was just wondering how it would be beneficial.
Yeah, John, you can speak to this. Like, how, you know, what is the cultural impact
for our
this?
Listeners who... who need all the information?
Yeah. Well, you know, this Penobscot River watershed is the kind of the center of the homeland for the Penobscot Indian mm-hmm. Nation. It's been the homeland for the tribe for thousands of years. There's archaeology sites that go back 10,000 years within the drainage. And over that period of time, of course, the tribal people were dependent on the river and its vast natural resources for survival. It was the means for transportation to get where folks needed to get to gather everything they needed to survive. And that included food, of course, and mm-hmm. the vast runs of salmon, shad, and alewives that would come into the system every spring were very much welcomed many times after a harsh winter. And it was a great feast in the springtime when the hundreds of thousands of migratory fish would come back to the river to complete their life cycle.
And did the, as I was reading, the dam really interrupted this flow of fish?
Well, with the example of Atlantic salmon being, you know, an endangered species.
In that piece we listened to, it was saying that's very endangered.
The Vizi Dam, as many other dams do, interrupt this cycle, as you say, John. And so besides the salmon, what other parts of the ecosystem are being, you know, impacted?
Go ahead, Nick, take that one.
Okay. There's a whole range of migratory fish species that we have created an idea that nature doesn't recognize, which is that there's this hard boundary between freshwater and saltwater, and mm-hmm. that doesn't exist in nature. That exists in human thinking and in engineering projects that we've put on the ground. And our saltwater systems don't function well with the freshwater systems cut off from them and vice versa. So there's a huge range of impacts when you artificially separate these two systems. And, in terms of the species that you're talking about, it's shad, alewives, striped bass, eels, sea lamprey, salmon, all of the fish that eat the prey species, especially alewives, shad. So cod are affected by this, haddock are affected by this, halibut are affected by this. All of these fish that we used to be able to feed the state and indeed a lot of the world on from the Gulf of Maine. And so the impacts are really quite profound by forcing this idea that we have of separate systems on the earth, and it's, you know, it ripples throughout a whole bunch of different life cycles and ecosystems, and really affects, you know, everything from mink and whales and seals and otters to us, because it really negatively affects our ability to fish, for example, commercial fishing. There's no question that we've damaged our ground fisheries by cutting off a key source of food for them, which is fish like alewives and shad.
And John, when I spoke to you earlier, you had used the term everything is interrelated. Do you want to speak more to that?
Well, absolutely. And especially in the fisheries world, there are many, many obvious interrelationships between and amongst the various species and the species of mammals that consume them. And I think one great example that speaks to the value of alewives is the fact that in the springtime, when the young salmon fish, they call them smolts, when the young salmon smolts are on their way out to the ocean, that would be approximately the same time that the adult alewives would be coming into the system to spawn in the lakes. And so all the various critters that would be feeding on the salmon smolts that are on their way out would now have another source of food, that being the alewives. And there's millions of alewives coming into the system. They serve as what biologists call a prey buffer, and they provide an alternative source of food for cormorants, eagles, osprey, otters, seals, and everything else that's in the system feeding, you know, looking for something to eat. And there's many, many other examples, where these interrelationships are extremely important. And,
one of the most interesting ones, I think, is the relationship between sea lamprey and the ability of salmon to make their nests. And sea lamprey they're not a popular huggable fish. They're probably, you know, less attractive than eels. Although in other parts of the world, people fish for sea lamprey as food, and they're quite prized. They're supposedly delicious. I've never eaten one. But the sea lamprey, when they make their nests, they prepare the bottom in such a way that female salmon can utilize it when the sea lamprey are done with their nest. It's a perfect substrate for the female salmon to lay their eggs. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes back to what John is saying, that it's really hard to restore just one of these species, all of these anadromous fish and catadromous fish, the ones that breed in the ocean, ones that breed in the lake, but that swim both ways. They're all dependent on each other. And without restoring the whole lot of them, it's difficult to imagine that we're just going to be able to restore the salmon. We have to restore them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, just listening to that, I mean, it's pretty, I mean, I find it sort of eye-opening. It's just a reminder that, you know, everything is, you know, interweaves into, you know, into another. And
now, with the, you know, the opening up, I'm assuming this will make it easier, perhaps, to have access to these fish if they have more of a way to get through areas, and they're not blocked off. Will there be care taken in fishing them? Because I know that's an issue, is that we've done this with lobster, and the big thing right now is the L-wives, is that we way overfish them. And I'm wondering if that's something people, a part of opening up this space, you know, I know it's going to be a huge resource for humans, but if there will be care taken and not overfishing?
Yeah, I'm certain that there will be at the federal level, the state level, and the tribal level as well. All three of those governments do have processes in place to enact fishing regulations and to keep track of the various populations, so that there will be the opportunity to put additional fishing regulations in place where needed.
I actually think that our targeted fisheries for alewives have been pretty well managed by the state of Maine. I don't think we're overfishing alewives.
Okay.
I think what we did to alewives is block them from their spawning habitat, and that's the biggest reason for their crash. However, there is a major concern that herring trawlers in the ocean are taking a lot of alewives as bycatch, and that hasn't been really resolved yet.
And what do you mean exactly by bycatch?
So they're not targeting alewives. They're not actually after alewives when they're fishing in the ocean. They're after the Atlantic herring. Mm-hmm. But they catch alewives as well. And it's not entirely clear how many of them they're catching. And that makes it difficult to factor that variable into fisheries impacts. But I actually think our state rules about alewife fishing here in Maine are pretty good, and the alewife fishermen have done a good job of not taking too many of the fish. I think it's definitely true that in other states they have overfished them,
and
that's why in Maine we still have commercial alewife fishing.
And we would love to talk to you more, but we're nearing the very end of our show.
Unfortunately.
So we have been speaking with Nick Bennett, who is a staff scientist for the Natural Resource Council of Maine, and John Banks, director of the Natural Resources Department for the Penobscot Nation. And we had a piece from Matt Osmond, and we listened to two pieces from the Salt Institute. Thank you to our engineers, Matt, Adam, and Milena.
But to Nick and to John, this conversation was definitely cut short, and there's, you know, so much more that could be said. But
you've been listening to Blunt Youth Radio. I'm Olivia Bradstreet.
And I'm Iris San Giovanni.
Thank you for listening.